Hi, everyone. This is our first session on Merleau-Ponty's The Structure of Behavior. So we finished our Simondon reading a couple weeks ago, and then we did one session reading a paper by Thierry Mouta on the reflex theory of behavior, which is relevant to the book we're about to read. So this reflex theory was a theory in physiology and psychology in the early 20th century, which was based on this notion of a reflex arc or reflex circuit. So essentially, there are these sort of automatic behaviors that a lot of animals exhibit. One that a lot of people are familiar with is the one where you go to the doctor's office and they take the little hammer and hit your kneecap, and then your leg sort of kicks out, and you don't even think about it, or you don't have to decide to kick your leg, and it's actually hard to prevent yourself from doing that if the doctor hits the right spot. So it's this sort of quasi-automatic response to a certain stimulus. So the hammer strikes a certain spot on your kneecap and something happens in your nervous system, and then the leg kicks out, and there's no sort of intervention of a conscious decision to move your leg. It just happens. And so this reflex theory took this as sort of like the building block of behavior that all sorts of animal behavior and human behavior, no matter how sort of complicated and sophisticated they might seem, are ultimately just built up out of these simple reflexes in some sort of complicated interaction with each other. And so like one famous example, and we'll talk a bit more about this today, is Pavlov's theory of the conditioned reflex. So for him, animals have these innate reflexes or unconditioned reflexes. So in one of the famous cases that he studied, dogs, for example, will salivate when they observe food, or when they, you know, see or smell food. So the stimulus is the either the odor or the sight of food. And then the response is salivation, release of saliva from glands in the mouth. And so this happens, like dogs don't have to learn how to do this, or they don't, dogs do this, like no matter what sort of upbringing or experience they've had. But then if you constantly associate the sight or smell of food with some other stimulus, like in his example, it was ringing a bell, what happens is the reflex response, or the unconditional response to the stimulus, gets sort of transferred to the new stimulus, which means that if you ring the bell without bringing the food, the dog starts to salivate anyway. So the salivation response, which was originally connected to the sight or smell of food, is now connected to the sound of a bell, which has no sort of intrinsic connection with food, which untrained dogs would not respond to food with. And so he studied like the different, what types of stimuli can you can undergo this kind of association. How long does this association last if it's not reinforced? For example, like if you keep ringing the bell without bringing food, eventually the dog will stop salivating. It loses that association. So et cetera, studying all the different properties of this association between a response and another stimulus. And so the sort of ambition of this reflex theory was to use this kind of conditioned response explanation to account for any kind of behavior that an animal might exhibit, all sorts of things that, might seem to require the postulation of like thought or intention or deliberation or something like that on the part of animals. Those should be explained in terms of how the animals have essentially been trained by their environment to respond in various ways to different types of stimuli. We talked about this last week, but essentially this theory didn't really work. There was an instance where some people tried to take this sort of training system out of the laboratory and start using it on to do demonstrations on animals, sort of public demonstrations of like getting animals to, perform some sort of weird trick, training them to to exhibit this behavior. And it turns out that when you do this, it doesn't really work that well. Animals have sort of species-specific behaviors that come out even when they haven't been trained, or that interfere with the trained behaviors. And so anyone who has a pet, I'm sure, will notice this. You can sort of try to train behaviors, and you know, dogs especially are good at learning all sorts of tricks. You can teach them how to sit, how to roll over, etc. But it's very hard to train a dog, like, I don't know, not to bark when a stranger comes in the house. Like, this is a kind of response that the dog exhibits. You can you know, give negative reinforcement of some kind to the dog whenever it does this. But it's very hard to repress this behavior that the dog sort of naturally exhibits. And so, these people who try to take this animal training system sort of on the road or outside the laboratory found that these species-specific behaviors interfered with the training a lot, and it was very hard to reliably produce the desired behaviors without having all these undesired behaviors also arising. And so that's sort of like an oversimplified account, but this sort of led to the decline of this reflex theory, and it was eventually more or less replaced in psychology with computational theories. So theories that try to understand cognition and behavior in terms of computation. So we look at how animals respond to their environment in terms of representation of that environment and some sort of operation on those representations, and then those representations then are used to trigger motor behavior of some kind, and then a new set of inputs and new representations and new operations on those representations. That's sort of like a nutshell version of the computational approach to cognition, which is still probably the dominant approach to cognition today. The other aspect of the paper that we looked at was a lot of the contemporary criticisms of the reflex theory. So people writing in the early 20th century who were critical of the reflex theory for a number of reasons. Merleau-Ponty was one of them, who we're skipping that whole chapter in the book because, again, this theory is sort of obsolete. He had a number of criticisms of the reflex theory, and among them was this notion that the reflex theory has requires sort of ad hoc hypotheses. So given that most animal behavior is not actually in its sort of observable form, it doesn't actually consist in these very simple stimulus response associations. You have to sort of come up with other explanations of how the more complex or more sophisticated seeming behavior is really sort of reducible to these simple reflexes. And we'll see more on this in the first part of chapter two when we get there, I think probably today. But Pavlov, for example, starts to introduce these relationships of excitation and inhibition. So one response or one stimulus can excite another, can excite a response, but it can also inhibit a response. And what the criticism is essentially that once you introduce these sort of opposing forces or these like opposite types of response, you can explain essentially anything. You can just say, oh, this phenomenon was brought about by excitation of Y, and then this other phenomenon was brought about by inhibition of X or whatever. However the animal responds to a stimulus, you can always say it was a reflex because it's either a excitatory or inhibitory reflex that is in play in that explanation. So the theory ends up becoming sort of vacuous because the sort of proverb is that if you can explain everything, you actually can't explain anything. Your theory is not actually sort of restricting the range of possibilities if everything that is potentially observable is actually explicable by your theory. You want your theory to say that this range of phenomena is what is possible, and not this other range of phenomena. And then you want to be able to show that that is actually correct. That's sort of like in very broad strokes, the type of criticism that Merleau-Ponty will give of the reflex theory. This is also associated with what we talked about last week, the ecological validity of the reflex theory. So one of the prominent criticisms was that these studies of conditioned responses in dogs or rats or other animals in a laboratory setting are very artificial, in the sense that a rat raised in a cage in a laboratory with constant lighting, constant air quality and so on, everything sort of held constant, this rat grows up to have a very different sort of psychological makeup than a rat living in the wild, where it has a complex environment to explore. It has all sorts of new smells and sights to try to understand. It interacts with other rats and potentially other animals. This very artificial laboratory setting produces a certain type of response. But what does that tell us about what rats are actually doing in the wild environment that is much more complex? It's not obvious that we can sort of extrapolate from this very controlled and artificial laboratory setting to the wild animal. So Angus was putting here in the chat that, there's this famous study that has sort of been incorporated into popular culture of this idea of the hierarchy in wolf packs of, there's the alpha wolf and the beta and so on. And it turns out that, I haven't looked at this in detail, but from what I've seen, this sort of behavior seems to be typical only of wolves in captivity. They develop this sort of hierarchy in a very restricted sort of zoo setting or something like that. Whereas in the wild, they have much more sort of flexible social roles. Individual wolves, interact in different ways depending on the circumstances, and they cooperate to hunt and share food and so on. So this idea that there's like this sort of rigid hierarchy of the alpha wolf and the beta wolf, etc., turns out to be a sort of an artifact of, it's obviously much easier to study wolves in a zoo than it is to, go into the wild and track a family of wolves over months to understand their social behavior. Again, this type of objection to the reflex theory was prominent already in the 30s. Based on the article we read, it's not clear how much these objections were really important in the defeat of the theory. A lot of times you have scientific theories that have objections raised against them. But as long as there's no like alternative theory that seems better, scientists will just continue to use the whatever theory is available, despite some of these objections. And then maybe decades later, when a new theory is developed, or the sort of standard approach in the discipline changes, then the old objections might get raised again. And people, will say, oh, that's obvious that this is wrong because of reason X. But 20 years earlier, no one thought reason X was decisive. The sort of evaluation of these arguments can change over time. And arguments that seem decisive after a theory has become obsolete, or after a new theory has been introduced that, is better for whatever reason, the old theory might seem to be defeated by an argument that at the time people just sort of dismissed or didn't really take seriously. Okay, so let's dive into the book. We're starting with the introduction, and then, as I mentioned, we're going to skip chapter 1 on the reflex theory and go to chapter 2. So for anyone following along, we're starting with page 3 of the book, so at the introduction. Angus, do you want to read the first, let's go with like 2 pages. First 2 pages or so.
No problem. I haven't read this yet, so I may read this a bit slow as I'm going through.
Yeah, no worries.
Introduction. Our goal is to understand the relations of consciousness and nature, organic, psychological, or even social. By nature, we understand here a multiplicity of events external to each other and bound together by relations of causality. With respect to physical nature, critical thought brings a well-known solution to this problem. Reflection reveals that physical analysis is not a decomposition into real elements, and that causality in its actual meaning is not a productive operation. There is then no physical nature in the sense we have just given to this word. There is nothing in the world which is foreign to the mind. The world is the ensemble of objective relations born by consciousness. It can be said that physics in its development justifies de facto this philosophy. One sees it employing mechanical, dynamic, or even psychological models indifferently, liberated from ontological pretensions, as if liberated from ontological pretensions, it were indifferent to the classical antinomies of mechanism and dynamism, which imply a nature in itself. The situation is not the same in biology. In fact, the discussions concerning mechanism and vitalism remain open. The reason for this is probably that analysis of the physico-mathematical type progresses very slowly in this area, and consequently, that our picture of the organism is still, for the most part, that of a material mass, partes extra partes. Under these conditions, biological thought most frequently remains realistic, either by juxtaposing separated mechanisms or by subordinating them to an entelechy. Okay. As for psychology, critical thought leaves it no other resource than to be, in part, an, quote, analytical psychology, unquote, which would discover judgment present everywhere in a way parallel to analytical geometry, and for the rest, a study of certain bodily mechanisms. To the extent that it has attempted to be a natural science, psychology has remained faithful to realism and to causal thinking. At the beginning of the century, materialism made the quote-unquote mental a particular sector of the real world. Among events existing in themselves, en soi, some of them in the brain also had the property of existing for themselves, pour soi. The counter-mentalistic thesis posited consciousness as a productive cause or as a thing. First, it was the realism of, quote, states of consciousness, unquote, bound together by causal relations, a second world parallel and analogous to the, quote, physical world, unquote, following the Humean tradition in a more refined psychology. Then in a more refined psychology, it was the realism of mental, quote, unquote, mental energy, which substituted a multiplicity of fusion and interpenetration, a flowing reality, for the disconnected mental facts. But consciousness remained the analog of a force. This was clearly seen when it was a question of explaining its action on the body, and when, without being able to eliminate it, the necessary, quote, creation of energy, unquote, was reduced to a minimum. The universe of physics was indeed taken as a reality in itself, in which consciousness was made to appear as a second reality. Among psychologists, consciousness was distinguished from beings of nature as one thing from another thing, by a certain number of characteristics. The mental fact, it was said, is unextended, known all at once. More recently, the doctrine of Freud applies metaphors of energy to consciousness and accounts for conduct by the interaction of forces or tendencies. Maybe I'll stop there, but this is interesting.
Yeah, I put in the chat, you can just read to the end of the introduction because it's like...
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
No problem. Thus, among contemporary thinkers in France, there exists side by side a philosophy, on the one hand, which makes of every nature an objective unity constituted vis-a-vis consciousness, and on the other, sciences which treat the organism and consciousness as two orders of reality, and in their reciprocal relation as quote-unquote effects and as quote-unquote causes. Is the solution to be found in a pure and simple return to critical thought? And once the criticism of realistic analysis and causal thinking has been made, is there nothing justified in the naturalism of science, nothing which, quote-unquote, understood and transposed, ought to find a place in a transcendental philosophy? We will come to these questions by starting, quote, from below, unquote, and by an analysis of the notion of behavior. This notion seems important to us because, taken in itself, it is neutral with respect to the classical distinctions between the quote-unquote mental and the quote-unquote physiological, and thus can give us the opportunity of defining them anew. It is known that in Watson, following the classical antinomy, the negation of consciousness as, quote, internal reality, unquote, is made to the benefit of physiology. Behavior is reduced to the sum of reflexes and conditioned reflexes between which no intrinsic connection is admitted. But precisely this atomistic interpretation fails even at the level of the theory of the reflex, chapter one, and all the more so in the psychology, even the objective psychology, of higher levels of behavior, chapter two, as Gestalt theory has clearly shown. By going through behaviorism, however, one gains at least in being able to introduce consciousness not as psychological reality or cause, but as structure. It will remain for us to investigate the meaning and the mode of existence of these structures. This is pretty compact, and there's a lot of ground covered here, obviously. But this idea that physics is more amenable to critical philosophy than biology is kind of interesting. He seems to think it's because physics is indifferent as to mechanical, dynamic, or even psychological models. I'm not sure what that refers to, psychological. And in biology, there's an explicit, this antinomy between mechanism and vitalism, which I guess obligates scientists to make claims about the transcendentally real. I don't really understand the point about analytical psychology here, the bottom of page three.
A couple of sort of clarification points are, the first one, he mentions criticism here, and as Angus mentioned, so criticism here means Kantian philosophy, or maybe neo-Kantian in some sense, as opposed to a direct reference to Kant. This is an approach to especially physics, and like Kant himself was especially interested in physics as an example of a science. So it's an approach to physics and by extension science in general, which takes it that it starts from the idea that anything that we describe as necessary, any necessary connection in the world or laws of nature that we treat as necessary, goes beyond what can be directly observed in our experience. And this is like Hume's point about causation, for example. So you can observe that event A is always followed by event B, but you can never observe that event A causes event B. You can never actually see causation happening, according to Hume. And Kant takes on this idea, and he takes it that there's a lot of sort of theoretical machinery that he builds up on this, but there has to be some sort of intellectual operation involved in attributing necessity to some sort of physical process, for example, or law of nature. And the only way we can actually sort of ground this necessity claim is to connect it to the possibility of experience in general. The law of causation, or this idea that everything that happens in the world is a result of some causal process, we have to understand this as being part of the structure of what makes possible experience in the first place. So it's not that we have experience of these isolated events and then we make some inference about, you know, the causal relationships between them. Is that like causation has to already be there before we can even have an experience of an event in the first place. That's sort of like a very brief summary of the sort of criticist position that Merleau-Ponty is talking about here. And so he mentions that this seems to be more successful in physics, or more accepted in physics than it is in biology. And this fits with Kant's own distinction that he makes, in the Critique of Pure Reason, he's thinking primarily of physics when he talks about natural science. And then he has his own book on the metaphysical foundations of natural science, where he's explicitly talking about physics. And then in the Critique of the Power of Judgment, the second part of the book, he talks about well, it's kind of an anachronism to call it biology, but the science of the natural world. And he says, in a sort of oversimplified way, he says that there can't really be a science of living beings. The famous line is there will never be a Newton of a blade of grass. So he thinks that we'll never be able to sort of come up with laws of biology in the same way that you can come up with laws of physics. These statements of necessary connection or necessary laws in biology in the same way there are in physics. So the sort of complicated thing is that at the same time, he thinks that we are sort of inescapably, we have to use teleological judgments when we think about living organisms. So judgments that have to do with a finality or in biology, if you open any biology textbook, you'll see things about the function of this organ or the function of this part of a cell and so on. And a function, of course, is a teleological concept. It has to do with what this element is for, why it's there or something along those lines. And for Kant, in thinking about living organisms, we inevitably have to use these teleological judgments, but at the same time, we can never treat them as having objective validity. We can never say that, this function or this finality is an actual element of nature. It's just something that we have to think whenever we think about the living being. So it's kind of a subtle position, and probably not a very satisfying one. It leaves the world of living beings in this kind of this sort of ambiguous position where we have to think about them in a certain way, but we can't actually treat that as the truth about those beings. So it's unsatisfying in various ways, but that's sort of an aside. So Merleau-Ponty is here talking about this position in physics, but he says in biology this doesn't really apply. This criticist position doesn't really work in biology in the same way, or it's not as widely accepted, because we have this opposition between vitalism and mechanism, which are two sort of opposed positions on the nature of living beings. And so this is sort of the context of the early 20th century biology, where these were two positions that were defended by prominent biologists. And for example, in embryology, this was a particularly important debate because certain embryologists had, for example, looked at the way that there's a sort of self-regulation of development in the sense that if you take an embryo or, especially in the early stages of development and you perform certain operations on it, if, for example, you take the embryo and you remove part of it, a certain portion, 10%, say, what happens is not just that the rest of the cells sort of keep developing in the same way they would otherwise, and then an organism with a missing leg or tail or whatever develops. Instead, what you have is the whole structure of the embryo is kind of transformed, and in such a way that the result is an organism that looks complete. It has all the different organs and parts and so on, but it's just 10% smaller than it would have been, or whatever percentage of the early embryo you had removed. So what this means is that the actual development of individual cells within this embryo is not some sort of what it was taken to show is that there's some sort of direction to this process of development of the embryo. So the final state of the organism as it's born or hatched or whatever is sort of directing the development process, so that even when it's disturbed in some way by the experimenter, this sort of end state somehow is able to reorganize the remaining material in such a way as to produce something as close to the end state as the normal end state as possible. So this is the vitalist position. And so this idea, this entelechy, is this force or form, or it's generally left fairly vague what exactly we're supposed to take this to mean, but something that directs the whole process of development of organisms and leads them towards some sort of finality or end or something along those lines. And then the opposed position is the mechanistic position, which denies that there's any such thing and wants to instead explain the development of embryos in terms of, for example, chemical interactions in the embryo, the way that different enzymes and eventually the discovery of DNA, of course, contributed a lot to this position. This idea that the cell produces particular proteins by sort of copying off the DNA template produces proteins, and then there's very complicated interactions of these different proteins and signaling chemicals and so on that bring about the final structure of the organism. But there's nothing like a sort of force or form or vital power, whatever exactly that would mean, that is sort of directing the process. It's just this very complicated interaction of chemicals and substances and things that are understandable in terms of causality. So this is sort of the opposition that was in play in the early 20th century between vitalists and mechanists. So Merleau-Ponty talks about this opposition. He turns to psychology instead as the sort of second instance of this, where he looks at, he calls this analytical psychology. I'm not sure exactly who he has in mind with this term, but this is again an approach to psychology that sees the sort of key element to be the judgment. This idea of, for example, unconscious inferences was a popular one. Helmholtz is sort of associated with this term. So for example, when you see a distant object, and you recognize that it's not actually just a tiny car that's close, you recognize it as a normal sized car. Yeah, Helmholtz. So you recognize that the car is sort of a normal sized car that's distant, as opposed to a tiny car that's close. This sort of unconscious inference explanation says is that you sort of receive this retinal stimulation that might sort of produce this impression of a tiny car, but then you perform some sort of judgment or inference process that, cars don't change size randomly like this, and therefore a car is, likely to be normal sized and therefore must be distant. And so this is how we have this sort of perception of size constancy, is this unconscious inference process. This sort of approach takes it that the judgment is sort of the central concept of psychology. Everything that we do is a sort of mental process of judging, of making a statement about a sort of mental statement about the properties of objects, for example. And then he sort of contrasts this with what he calls, he contrasts this with a whole sort of group of positions that take consciousness or the psychological level to be a causal force of some kind. And you can even sort of bring this back to Descartes. He doesn't do that here, but like for Descartes, of course, there's this dualism of the body and the mind or the soul. But then there's this sort of strange interaction that happens in the pineal gland for him, where the animal spirits coursing through our nerves that bring about the motions of our body, the soul can't change the quantity of movement in the body, but it can change the direction of movement. By changing the direction of the animal spirit's movement in our nerves, the soul brings about motions of the body in a particular direction or of a particular form. And of course, the problem with this theory is that even if you, like, the animal spirits are meant to be this very thin fluid, like a gas, I guess, is what we would say in contemporary terms. So it's this very sort of ethereal matter or very light matter or something like that. But at the same time, it's still matter. And for Descartes, there's this substantial difference. There's a difference of essence between matter as an extended substance and mind as a thinking thing. And So they're completely different entities. And so it's still, you know, no matter how sort of ethereal or fine or whatever this animal spirit substance is, there's still a difference of essence between animal spirits and the mind. And so how the mind is able to direct the motion of animal spirits is still a mystery. And there's, you know, more sort of technical problems with this physics of, for Descartes, there's the quantity of motion is preserved, and Leibniz eventually showed that you can, on the basis of this physics, you can invent a perpetual motion machine, which is generally taken to be impossible. This would be a machine that sort of powers itself forever. If only the quantity of motion is preserved and not the quantity of force or something, quantity of energy or something along those lines, then you can have a machine that just powers itself forever. And so this is taken as a sort of refutation of Descartes' physics. And so this means that you can't have preservation of the quantity of motion with freedom for the direction of motion to be changed. So that's, you know, again, sort of a technical aside to that problem. But the general problem here is, like, if we take the psychical or the mental to have causal force of some kind, then we have to give some sort of explanation of how this mental level or mental aspect of the world or mental life is able to interact with the physical world in some way. And this is, like, there's a whole sort of discipline in analytic philosophy of mind that is, like, looks at this problem and tries to come up with solutions to it. And most of them, I think, are not very plausible or interesting ones. But in general, this is, like, the whole sort of set of positions that Merleau-Ponty is talking about here is any of these positions that take it that consciousness or the psychological has causal efficacy. It's able to bring about some sort of effect in the physical world. And so he mentions here also Freud, who, of course, sort of models psychological life on one of his models is an energetic model. So you have, like, libido, for example, taken as a kind of energy that can be transferred from one portion of the mind or one aspect of the mind to the other. And then the different, like, kinds of drives can interact with each other in this sort of quasi-energetic way, as if it's sort of modeled on the interaction of forces. What Merleau-Ponty wants to do is to sort of overcome this opposition between this sort of judgment approach, where the world and consciousness are these two separate spheres, and everything we do in psychology is about the kinds of judgments that consciousness makes about the physical world, and then the other tradition or approach where consciousness has this physical or this effect on the physical world, it somehow interacts with the physical world. So he wants to overcome this opposition or find an alternative that doesn't sort of rely on this opposition. And his sort of strategy that he proposes here is to start from this concept of behavior, which, of course, is associated with the behavioristic school in physics. So he mentions Watson here, who was, I think, taken as the founder of the behavioristic school in the U.S. We talked a little bit about him last week. But what's interesting about the concept of behavior for Merleau-Ponty is that behavior is neither sort of a purely physical process. It's not just something that has to do with the movement of bodies, when you change a temperature or chemical composition or whatever. But it's also not like an inner psychological process. It's not sort of contained within consciousness. So behavior is something that we can observe animals doing or other humans doing. But at the same time, it's not just a movement of bodies. Partly this has to do with the sort of directedness of behavior, right? So we describe something as behavior that an animal does insofar as it has some sort of connection to goals that we can ascribe to the animal. Like an animal that falls off a cliff, we wouldn't describe the falling as a behavior of the animal, but the animal that sort of climbs up the cliff, we would describe that as behavior if we can, you know, figure out that there's some purpose or goal or that we can connect this action of the animal or the movements that the animal performs in climbing the cliff, if we can say that it has some sort of connection with the general life, I don't know, project or direction of the animal. It's, you know, it could be it's escaping a predator or finding food or returning to his nest or whatever, something like this. So behavior already involves, or the sort of general concept of behavior involves some kind of connection to the life of the animal as a whole, as opposed to just a sort of movement of masses in space. Yeah, so something like agency seems to be involved in behavior. And then, you know, we'll see more about this, but the behaviorists try to understand behavior without this sort of notion of agency, or like try to reduce behavior to purely physiological terms. But Merleau-Ponty will criticize this attempt as sort of a illusory reduction. It sort of masks the real, it takes this description, it tries to describe behavior in purely physiological terms, but in doing so, it either ends up in contradictions or sort of smuggles in these sort of agency-related concepts that were supposed to be excluded. He wants to start from this concept of behavior because it's sort of not reducible, or the sort of basic concept of behavior doesn't fall neatly into the categories of the psychological or mental on the one hand and the physical on the other hand. So if we sort of analyze this concept of behavior and, you know, the kinds of difficulties that we run into when we try to study behavior in various ways, then we can ultimately reach a better conception of what consciousness or the psychological is, which is sort of the end goal of this book, or the what we get to in the final chapter. So it would be an account of consciousness or the psychological, which is not either sort of external to the physical world or this kind of weird, interaction of the mental and the physical that is, you know, left kind of mysterious. It's sort of overcoming this opposition and giving us a better concept of consciousness or the psychological that doesn't leave us in the alternative of either of these positions. That's sort of my unpacking of the introduction. Sorry, that was a bit long, but the introduction is quite dense. We will see a lot more in a lot more detail how he goes through these concepts and ideas in the rest of the book.
Yeah, I guess that one of the things that isn't super clear for me, at least for now, is the division that he makes between events existing in themselves and some events in the brain that have the property of existing for themselves. Is this related to this idea of the mental as something that doesn't have, mental aspect of the real world that would be isolated from the other aspect? Or I guess I don't really exactly understand if this is a division that people who think of the mental as having a causal role would agree with, or if it's saying that it's the other school of thought that would think of it that way.
Yeah, as far as I understand, this is, so he described this as a materialist position. So the idea here is that certain materialist philosophers, physicists, psychologists, etc., in the 19th century would sort of, there was, I think it was Haken, who said that the brain secretes consciousness the same way that the stomach secretes acid. So that, like, consciousness or the mental would just be a property of the brain. Certain parts of the material world have this property of being conscious of themselves, or having being for themselves is the way that Merleau-Ponty expresses it here. So, like, there is something it is like to be a brain, whereas there isn't something that it's like to be a shoe or a desk or whatever. There is an experience, a subjective side to a brain, but this is just a sort of property that it has as an entity, the same way that, you know, a shoe might have property, you know, chemical composition and a certain mass and so on. The brain has, you know, all these, you know, chemical and whatever other properties, but it also has this property of being for itself. So it's just one sort of property among others. And, you know, there were various different, like, approaches to how to handle this property among different materialist philosophers or philosophers who were interested in this type of explanation. Like, there were some who took it that the subjective and objective side, or, like, you know, matter and mind were sort of, they took a sort of quasi-Spinozistic position that they were sort of coextensive, that there's mind everywhere, but it's just, in, you know, sort of realized in different degrees. And so, like, the human mind would be, like, the sort of most perfect or the most developed instance of mind, but there would still be something like a subjective side of things, even in the case of the shoe. And then others just sort of took it that they just sort of gave a sort of promissory note that, you know, someday physiology will be able to account for why brains exhibit consciousness but not shoes. But, you know, it's just something that we haven't figured out yet. It's just like, you know, physiology isn't developed yet, isn't developed enough yet to explain this, but it's in principle not any more mysterious why the brain produces consciousness than it is why the stomach is capable of digesting food, for example. Different approaches to this question among materialists, but in general, it's just this idea that the subjective or the for itself or the fact that there's something it is like to be an entity of some kind, this aspect of the world is just one property among others that certain parts of the world or potentially all parts of the world exhibit, as opposed to like other corollary of this, or the consequence of this, is that we don't need to include consciousness as a part of the explanation of events that, or like the actions of organisms, for example. We can always treat consciousness or the subjective side of things as accompanying the events happening in the brain of the animal or the nervous system of the animal more generally. So the real story of explanation is happening at the level of the nervous system. And then the consciousness is sometimes is described as an epiphenomenon. So it's just a sort of accompanying property of the causal story that's happening in the nervous system. And we don't actually have to appeal to consciousness in our explanations at all. And so this is why Merleau-Ponty here contrasts this with the other sort of form of explanation that does attribute a causal role to consciousness. Any of these theories that take consciousness to affect the physical world in some way of, you know, controlling behavior or interacting with the physical in whatever mysterious way, these are all a different sort of style of explanation or a different tradition than these accounts of consciousness as an epiphenomenon or as this sort of property that certain parts of the material world have.
All right, got it. I see, I understand. That's interesting that those, I commented inside a bit, those approaches that you mentioned, where consciousness is understood as something that appears gradually everywhere, so to speak, and humans maybe have the bigger degree of it. As far as I know, after David Chalmers started, the whole debate about the hard question of consciousness again, those kinds of positions have reappeared on the scene, in this, I guess, last 20 or 30 years. So I guess that's an interesting thing to see how, these old debates kind of come back, in a sense, I guess in a slightly different way, but yeah, thanks.
Yeah, so there's definitely a lot more interest in panpsychism, so this doctrine that everything exhibits a subjectivity of some kind, or there is an experience of what it's like to be a shoe or a piece of desk or whatever. So this position is treated a lot more seriously now, even if it's probably still a minority position, but it's treated as like a viable option in a way that it wasn't in, say, like the mid 20th century. And so one of the, yeah, so the piece of desk example, the reason I sort of put it that way is because one of the sort of objections that's been raised to this position is like how how does this subjectivity of a component sort of contribute or combine into the subjectivity of the whole? So like as human beings, we have something like a unitary experience or unitary consciousness. Like you don't have like it's not the case that we have sort of a consciousness of my right hand and a consciousness of my left hand as like two independent things. We instead have a sort of unitary consciousness of me as a whole that has a left and a right hand. And so like if it's the case that my left hand, you know, as a sort of entity treated in itself has a subjective experience, then what connection would there be between this sort of subjective experience of the part and the subjective experience of the whole? It's not obvious that the, you know, this attributing consciousness to the part actually gets us anywhere in terms of explaining why the whole has a conscious experience, because we still have to, you know, account for that combination or the contribution of the part to the whole. This is one of the sort of standard objections to panpsychism. A piece of a desk, or, you know, if the desk has a subjective experience, does like, you know, the 1 square meter of desk have a conscious experience, or like 1 fiber of wood in the desk or whatever? It leads us to some kind of abstruse questions about, like, you know, where we draw the line exactly, and, you know, what the relationship is between these different conscious experiences. Yeah, so Leibniz, yes, would say yes to all of those questions. So every element, you know, every portion of matter, it doesn't just exhibit conscious experience, but it actually is a conscious experience. So subjectivity is actually all there is. And matter is infinitely divided. It's not just divisible, it's divided. So there are infinitely many monads that are all expressing each other's essences. That's a sort of an aside, but a very interesting attempt to solve some of these problems. Just one note, the last thing I would mention here is that unfortunately in this translation, the in the French text, there are footnotes, but in the translation, they're put as endnotes. And, you know, I think endnotes are like the worst invention that scholarship has ever come up with. That's an exaggeration, but yeah, it's it's very annoying. I will try to point out whenever, like, a lot of these notes are just like references to, you know, whatever sources he's citing or whatever. Whenever there's one that seems like it's important to bring up, I'll try to point that out. And then if someone could like skip to the end of the PDF and quote and, you know, put it in the chat at some point, that would be very helpful, because when we're reading the text, it's hard to I saw that. Yeah, thanks. It's hard to sort of jump back and forth in the PDF while you're reading. So I'll try to point them out when I see them in the French text, where they're like worth looking at and not just references to the sources. Okay, like I said, we're gonna skip chapter one. And we'll skip to up to chapter two. So let's skip ahead to page 52 in the book. So I'll give everyone a second to find that. Bats, would you like to read a couple pages until we get to like a sort of natural stopping point?
Yeah, sure. I can read. Let me find the page.
It's page 82 in the PDF, but 52 in like the actual page numbers of the book.
Yeah, okay, I think I'm here. Higher forms of behavior, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, Pavlov's reflexology and its postulates. The analysis of perceptual behavior was initially developed as the complement and extension of the reflex theory. The problem which Pavlov posed for himself was to discover how the organism can enter into relationship with a much richer and more extended milieu than that which acts immediately on its sensory endings in the form of physical and chemical stimulations. But this extension of the milieu is obtained by transferring the power of the natural excitants to new stimuli. It is only a question of multiplying the commands which our inborn reactions depend upon, and, in particular, of grouping them into chains of automatic reaction. It is always by the summation of the proprioceptive and exteroceptive stimuli present at each moment, the powers which are conditioning delegates to them being taken into account. The powers which conditioning delegates to them being taken into account, that one proposes to understand behavior. The essence of nerve activity remains the same. It is a process which can be broken down into real parts. Since the quote-unquote situation remains a mosaic of physical and chemical excitants, and since the new connections result from the de facto contiguities which are encountered there, they will be initially established without choice and in all directions. For Pavlov, development will consist in a series of compensated errors, as thus learning for psychological empiricism. Every stimulus which acts on the organism conjointly with an unconditioned stimulus tends to take upon itself the reflexogenic power of the latter. From this would result the syncretic appearance of infantile and animal reactions. For some time, a conditioned excitant could even communicate something of its power to any excitant, even to one which had never been associated with the absolute excitant. But this first law is not sufficient to explain the adjustment of our behavior to the essential aspects of a situation. A selection must be made among the possible conditioned excitants, and the reflex must be focused. Thus, we are led to conceive of a counterforce which enters in to correct the effects of irradiation and to prevent just any stimulus from provoking just any one of the reactions with which it has been associated. Thus, in Pavlov, it is inhibition which will be conceived as a positive process capable of compensating for the disorder effects of irradiation. Okay, I'll read this as well. Take, for example, a sound S, which has never been associated with powdered meat, and which is presented several times along with a luminous excitant L, which has become the conditioned stimulus of gastric secretion. Initially, it acquires a weak reflexogenic power by irradiation, but soon loses it. A stimulus associated with a conditioned stimulus becomes inhibiting when the latter is not joined to the absolute excitant, conditioned inhibition. Moreover, the sound, like any new stimulus which is introduced in a customary situation, already possessed an inhibiting power, external inhibition, from the moment of its first occurrence. The effects of conditioned inhibition, which are of particular interest to us, are the sound having become inhibiting by conditioned inhibition, ends up by completely restraining the reflex, and no gastric secretion is any longer observed when the light and sound are presented together. If the ticking of a metronome is added to this group of excitants, and the new grouping associated with powdered meat, a gastric secretion is obtained, but it is weak and only half as much as the luminous excitant produced by itself at the beginning of the experiment. This is because the new excitant M has, as such, an inhibiting action, external inhibition, which will influence the stimulating power of L just as much as the inhibiting power of S. Restraint of the restraint, M should in this sense augment the reflexogenic power of the group L plus S, if it did not at the same time diminish that of L, as is shown by a control experiment in which, associated with the light alone, M is sufficient to reduce the gastric secretion which the former is capable of evoking. But if we continue to associate the three excitants together with the meat powder, we finally obtain the following results, where the numbers indicate the number of drops of saliva collected. So here L is equal to 10, L plus M is equal to 10, M alone is equal to 4, and S is equal to 0, and then L plus S plus M is equal to 10, S plus M is equal to 4, and L plus S is equal to 0. If we want to interpret this result within the system of concepts defined by Pavlov, we will have to say that S, when it is joined to M, no longer exercises an inhibiting influence, and that M, often associated with the meat powder along with L plus S, has in this way acquired a certain reflexogenic power. From this we get the results M equals 4, S plus M equals 4. But on the other hand, joined to L, which is a very good excitant, S recovers an inhibiting power which it no longer manifested. L plus S is equal to 0. Thus, everything happens as if the excitant M played a role which is not foreseen by the laws formulated up to this point, as if its presence suddenly modified the power of S to such an extent that, although S plus L is inefficacious, M plus S plus L produces 10 drops of saliva. It does not appear that the effects of a group of stimuli can be treated as the algebraic sum of the effects of each one of them taken separately. It is here that Pavlov invokes a sort of nerve equilibrium, a sort of nerve equilibrium, the nature of which cannot be made any more precise, end quote. It is true that we have not yet brought into play a third law which, if it proves to be one, might make it possible to fill the gaps between theory and experience. Until now, the stimulating or inhibiting power has not depended upon the nervous system itself, but only on the associations achieved in the experiment. That is, in short, on the course of physical nature. Pavlov also brings into play transverse functions, end quote. Although in the completely mechanical form, it is true of, open quotes, reciprocal induction, end quotes. Every excitation in a point of the cortex provokes an inhibition in the neighboring regions, and inversely, this new law has the effect of accentuating the limitations of stimulated and inhibited zones in the cortex, and compensates in this way for the effects of the first two. Okay, I would appreciate if we stopped here to discuss a bit what this last section meant.
The way I think it's a good place to talk.
Yeah. I guess that he's introducing this idea of the inhibitors, basically changing the entire relationship of all the stimuli that they appear together with the reflex, right? Or that's the way I see it in like a very broad sense.
Yeah, and the problem here is not just, so yeah, he introduces this notion of reflex, we can think of this as like the excitatory and inhibitory effects of different stimuli. We could think of this as like plus and minus signs, right? Where like there's the absolute, absolute excitant, right? So like the meat powder. So this is something that the dog doesn't need to learn to respond to by salivating. It just does this no matter what. So this has, like, say, if you give this the number 10, just you can just arbitrarily assign it a number. Then some other stimulus, like the metronome, might have an inhibiting effect. You could say, like, we might explain this by saying the dog is distracted by the metronome, the ticking of the metronome, and it therefore has less response to the meat powder. And so you could say, like, the metronome has a sort of inhibitory power of -6, for example. So then you would just add them together, and the result would be 4. You would just have 10 minus 6 equals 4, and that's just a sort of product. So each of the excitation and the inhibition would just be two quantities that you just add together in this very simple way. One happens to be positive, one happens to be negative. But what happens, like what the series of experiments that he talks about here shows is that when you have multiple different stimuli, like a light and the metronome and the meat powder, you end up with contradictions in terms of which things are supposed to inhibit and which ones are supposed to be excitatory. So if you try to assign quantities, like if you take the sort of table that he gives here, with L equals 10, L plus M equals 10, etc. If you try to assign quantities to each of the letters and just solve these equations, you end up with contradictions. There's no quantities you can assign to these letters that would make these equations all true at the same time. So like if you try to say that the metronome has a inhibitory power of -6 because it reduces the salivation response by 60% compared to just presenting the meat powder alone. Then in another context where you have like the meat powder plus the metronome plus a light, it turns out that you can't actually assign the quantity -6 to the metronome because it gives you the wrong result. And So, like, this is obviously a sort of technical criticism of one element of this experiment, but what is sort of what Merleau-Ponty takes it to reveal here is the insufficiency of this idea that the reflexes are these sort of atoms of behavior or these self-contained entities that are just sort of combined with each other without modifying each other in any way. And we see this in the sort of third law that Pavlov has to introduce, this notion of the nerve equilibrium. And he even says himself, the nature of which cannot be made any more precise. So he just sort of postulates there's this something else in the operation of the nervous system that makes all these things work, and we don't know anything about it. And so here we have some sort of like, and our theory, we start with this very simple theory that, you know, we have these reflexes that are just self-contained entities, and then we just combine them together and they don't actually change in any way. They just sort of are built up into, it's like taking bricks and building a wall out of them. And the bricks don't actually change in that process. And then when we reach a contradiction or reach this sort of result that we can't explain using that theory, we postulate this other process that, you know, actually the bricks do change somehow. But we keep the starting point. So these bricks are supposed to be atoms, but they actually do have to change. And so, this is a sort of ad hoc hypothesis that's just meant to solve this contradiction, but it doesn't actually like tell us anything, or it doesn't really help us understand behavior in any real sense. It's just like sort of finding a way to get out of the difficulty by renaming the problem, essentially.
Yeah, I guess that like the explanatory nature of these inhibitors, yes, kind of becomes a bit more, well, weaker when the empirical data doesn't really lend itself to such an easy analysis, right? And you have to do these ad hoc justifications to, I guess, fit your model to the data instead of seeing the data as refuting the model in some way.
Yeah, like if you could, so like the very simple sort of starting point would be, yeah, you have these inhibitions and excitations that just add up to each other and that gives you your results. You just count, you know, how many inhibitions are there and how strong is each of those inhibitions. Add them up. How many excitations are there? How strong is each one? Add them up. You know, add up those two quantities of excitation and inhibition, and that gives you your results. So as discussed in this section, if you try to do that, you end up with contradictory quantities. You can't find quantities that actually make those equations work. So this very simple account is like doesn't match the empirical observations of, you know, what actually happens when you start combining stimuli when you have a complex situation as opposed to the simple situation. And so one response to this would just be to say, okay, therefore we have shown that this very simple reflex theory is incorrect, and we need a different account of, you know, how behavior is built, or like what is it that complex behavior, what is the relationship between complex behavior and simple behavior. We would sort of need to come up with an alternative, but that's not what Pavlov does. He says, you know, this reflex theory is still correct, except we just need this third law, this nerve equilibrium that we don't know anything about. And once we have this third law, then everything sort of works. It's always open to do this. And it's not necessarily, like we talked a little bit about this last week, about how in general in science, there's no sort of straightforward way of saying that, you know, one response to a problem is the correct one, like from the outset. It's only by trying it and seeing how successful it is and, you know, what sorts of new problems arise and so on, that you can really determine that one approach is like a good one and the other one was not a good one. But it's pretty clear that once you start introducing these, you know, nerve equilibrium processes that you don't know anything about, that your approach is like kind of in trouble, that what seemed like a very clear and simple mode of explanation in terms of adding up excitations and inhibitions now starts to become much more sort of murky. This nerve equilibrium process is like how it's supposed to happen, like what exactly it entails, etc., is not clear. So our theory that we thought was very clear and obvious is now a lot less clear and a lot less obvious. So like one of the sort of advantages that our theory had of this clarity and simplicity is now gone. And so we have to, like, it's, you know, maybe we can find another reason or another advantage of our new theory that compensates for that. But we have lost something just by, you know, introducing this third law or this nerve equilibrium that, you know, that we don't really understand. I can read the next bit. This will probably be our last section, I think, before we end. So I'll read like a couple pages and then we'll discuss. Okay. The fact that Pavlov is forced to correct one law with another at each step doubtless proves that he has not discovered the central point of view by means of which all the facts could be coordinated. Excitant L being defined as a conditioned stimulus of the secretion, excitant S as a conditioned inhibition, and finally excitant M as a conditioned counter-inhibition, the reaction provoked by the group L plus S plus M ought to be composed of a rheosynthesis based on the properties of each one of them. But we have just seen that this explanation leaves a residue. Associated with M, the excitant S loses its inhibiting power, but it conserves it when associated with L. Thus, in the two quote-unquote situations, L plus S and the S plus M, the stimulus S does not play the same role. In other words, they are not two holes in which one could discover a common element S. But at this point, we realize that the description of behavior with which Pavlov started is already a theory. There is an initial presupposition that the processes in the organism which would be released by each of the elementary stimuli are contained in the complex excitation as real parts, or again, that each partial stimulus possesses its own efficacy. It is because of this postulate that if L is a positive conditioned excitant when presented alone, one will suppose that its proper power remains the same when it is joined to S. Since the new grouping produces no secretion, a positive inhibiting power will have to be attributed to S. But when L plus S enters into a larger grouping, the same realistic postulate will now necessitate our retaining for the group L plus S the inhibiting power which it has alone. Correlatively, the third term of the new group will be conceived as a counter-inhibitor since the group S plus L plus M produces a secretion. The idea of inhibition understood as a positive process, and with it the difficulties which we have just indicated, becomes inevitable only by the assumed necessity of treating a total excitation as the sum of the excitations which would be produced by each of the partial stimuli. But Pavlov himself cannot adhere to this principle, and we have seen him invoke a law of nerve equilibrium, which he in no way explicates in order to explain the effects of the group M plus S. Thus he himself indicates the direction in which his analysis should be modified. A given objective stimulus produces different effects in the organism depending on whether it acts alone or along with this or that other stimulus. If L provokes a certain reaction of the organism, there is no need to posit an inhibiting power in S in order to explain that L plus S does not produce it. L plus S is not reflexogenic because the adjunction of S is not a simple or even an algebraic addition for the organism. The preceding stimulus S is not left subsisting. A new situation of which S is no longer a part is substituted for it. In the same way, the group L plus S plus M can become reflexogenic by association with the meat powder without this property being transmitted to the group L plus S, which is qualitatively different for the organism. Thus, the genuine stimulus is the ensemble as such. Let's stop here. So this is essentially what I was just explaining here, that, so the sort of starting point that Pavlov takes is that there's this additivity of the stimuli. So stimulus A produces response B in isolation. Stimulus C produces response D in isolation. Therefore, if you combine stimulus A and B, then you get response C plus D. This is like, you know, the very simple presupposition that Pavlov makes in terms of how simple stimuli combine to in complex situations with multiple stimuli. And what the results that Merleau-Ponty talks about in this section, what those results show is that this very simple presupposition doesn't work. And this is something that Pavlov himself recognizes to some extent when he introduces this third law of nerve equilibrium. But he sort of recognizes it without actually acknowledging that this is a refutation of his starting point, or this is a sign that his starting point is incorrect. Because for Pavlov, he thinks he's just sort of describing the events when he says that, you know, stimulus A and stimulus B are each producing their effect in the combined stimulus A plus B. He thinks he's just giving a description of the events. He doesn't actually recognize that this account of this additivity of the stimuli is itself a theoretical presupposition So he sort of retains it, even though he actually acknowledges later in the account that it's not actually valid, because this nerve equilibrium process means that A and B are actually different when they enter into combination than they are isolated. And so what the sort of lesson that Merleau-Ponty draws from this is that we can only take, we have to take the whole, what he calls here the ensemble, or we could take it like the situation or something like that, you know, which we can't sort of specify exactly what that means yet. But in the complex stimulus, we have to take that as a whole, and we can't actually presuppose that the individual components that we might isolate in it, like the light and the sound and the temperature or whatever, that these actually are sort of combining in this additive way in the way that the organism responds to them. So we have to take the whole set of stimuli, the temperature and light and sound and everything, all at once as the stimulus, and not say that, you know, the temperature has effect A, and then the sound has effect B, and the light has effect C, and so therefore the joint effect of all three together is A plus B plus C. That's the inference that we're not allowed to make anymore, according to Merleau-Ponty. So then, I mean, the question that arises, of course, here is, if that's the case, then, like, how are we supposed to understand complex behavior or complex stimuli? Like, if all we're allowed to say is that, you know, this one specific situation, this complex stimulus that combines temperature and light and sound and everything has this specific effect, then it's hard to see how we can, like, do science, because every stimulus is going to be slightly different in some respects if you have to account for everything. Like, I don't know, you could even look at, like, the gravitational influence of the stars on the rat navigating the maze. You know, every time the rat navigates the maze, this gravitational influence is going to be slightly different. And so maybe that has an effect. Like, who knows whether that, so every ensemble, like every individual trial, every time you get the rat to run through the maze, is going to be a little bit different. You know, what the rat ate that day is going to be slightly different, or, you know, what the temperature of the room is slightly different, et cetera. So if every single, like, individual trial is different, and you can't decompose these situations into simple elements, then how do you produce any sort of, like, knowledge about, like, a sort of general statement about rats in situations like X have behavior Y or response Y? How do you get from every individual trial being a slightly different ensemble, how do you get from there to some sort of general knowledge about what rats in general do, or what animals in general do in a particular, in a more general class of situations, and not just one specific situation? So that's sort of the problem that, Merleau-Ponty doesn't give us an answer to this here, but this is the problem that you can raise of, like, what is the alternative if we are not allowed to presuppose additivity of component stimuli in the complex stimulus? How are we supposed to go about understanding behavior? So that's, I think, a question to sort of keep in mind as we read the rest of the book.
Yeah, it's interesting that in the context of this discussion of Pavlov, you know, this idea that the ensemble itself becomes what the organism associates, or, you know, the actual genuine stimulus for the organism, it seems like a really elucidating idea. But then, as you said, you know, once you dig a bit deeper into it, all of these problems, I guess, arise. That's all I have to say. I guess it's going to be interesting to see how he deals with that.
Yeah, and I think, like, one approach to this, like, one way of sort of getting past this problem would be to say that when we look at the behavior of organisms, we have to use our sort of interpretative faculty, or our capacity to understand, in some sense that is not strictly scientific, or that is not restricted to a natural scientific understanding of the world. So we have to sort of put ourselves in the place of the rat and understand, you know, what this complex stimulus means for the rat and how it responds to it. in this, we have to have kind of this capacity to put ourselves in the rat's place and experience that for ourselves. So this would be one way of understanding is so that animal behavior or the behavior of organisms in general can only be understood through something like empathy in a very broad sense. So like this kind of capacity to put yourself in the position of another organism. And this is something quite different from, making predictions of how the solar system will evolve over time. This would be a sort of ethological, a hermeneutic ethology, I guess you could say. So it's a kind of approach to animal behavior that looks at, that tries to understand animals by interpreting them as opposed to just predicting what the responses are going to be. This would be one sort of response. I'm not 100% sure that this is Merleau-Ponty's answer. I think that's something we can, think about as we read the rest of the book and see how that compares to his answer. But I think this is like a viable project of, trying to understand animals from their own perspective. And we talked a little bit about this last time about how a lot of animal psychology, by sort of neglecting the animal's perspective, was not able to sort of understand the animal's behavior in adequate terms. It, gave the animals an impoverished environment and then found that the animals were not capable of performing certain tasks. Whereas if you present the task in a way that the animal can respond to, then it is capable of performing that task. I think there's a lot of value in taking that perspective of the animal into account and designing our studies of animal behavior in such a way that such a way that they're sort of appropriate for the animal's perspective, and that allows the animal to exhibit the capacities that in other situations that are less appropriate to it, it might not be able to exhibit. And so, like, this is something that, lobotomizing them obviously is like the sort of the extreme case of this, you take it that, there's this very simple additive property of the stimulus response, and somehow the frontal lobes are like interfering with this. So if you just excise the frontal lobes, you can just study things in a much more simple way. This is supposed to tell us like about the sort of normal functioning of the animal. We see things much more clearly in the lobotomized animal, and then we can sort of extrapolate from that to the normal animal. And of course, this is like not actually the case. A normal animal is not just a lobotomized animal plus some extra functions of the frontal lobe. It's a completely different. You're doing something completely different when you're studying lobotomized animals than when you're studying normal animals. And likewise, if you only study rats in an impoverished lab environment that never have contact with any other rats or never get a chance to explore the environment, etc., then what exactly that tells us about the behavior of rats that are living in the wild, that explore very complex environments and have social interactions and so on. It's not obvious that we can like make those inferences, and there's a good chance that we're going to miss a lot of the complexity of the and the capacity that the rats are capable of exhibiting in their wild settings compared to these sort of artificial laboratory rats. So let's end here for today. So we will pick up again from what page are we on? Page 55. So we'll pick up from page 55 next time. I think in general we can probably read longer sections of this book in each reading passage compared to when we were doing Simon Don, where it was often quite dense, and so we would stop every page and discuss what is going on. There are some dense passages, but this is a little bit more straightforward in a lot of ways. So we can probably read two pages or so at a time and try to find a natural stopping point, I think. But we can adjust as we go along if things are particularly hard in some spots or whatever. But yeah, so thanks everyone for coming out and for your contributions. I hope to see you at the same time next week.